You're searching for something whole, cause what you see's real life. You're watching this world unfold, the truth beneath the lies. Rekindling what's been stole, the need to free one's mind. Uncover the truth exposed, so people see the light. Let's chant it down so we can know. It's simple, we just break it down to little bits so we can process all. Make the switch to elevate yourself to conscious mode. And it's beneficial, we can get this concept broke and get the future generations who want to stop the whole thing. With the masses demonstrating, we can start opposing, taking in, assimilating, getting lots of knowledge, waking up the population, trying to stop hypnosis.
Chant it down, radio's coming to you live from the Hawaiian Islands, coming from the perspective of complete freedom, coming from wisdom outside the system and then some. This is the mouthpiece of the natural earth forgotten. At this point in time, humanity's been kept from the truth, so Chant it down radio offers the coordinates to a path out.
You're searching for something whole, cause what you see's real life. You're watching this world unfold, the truth beneath the lies. Rekindling what's been stole, the need to free one's mind. Uncover the truth exposed, so people see the light. Let's chant it down so we can know. It's simple, we just break it down a little bit so we can process all. Make the switch and elevate yourself to conscious mode. And it's beneficial, we can get this concept rolling. Get the future generations wanna start the whole thing. With the message demonstrated, we can start a post. Taking in, assimilating, getting lots of numbers. Waking up the population, try to stop hypnosis.
Welcome back to Chant It Down Radio. This is episode 112, where we deprogram from the deep program. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for tuning in again. And rarely do I meet anyone who questions our existence and that understands that civilization is a problem itself. Civilization has torn apart the planet since its very inception, and it's left a scar across the earth from using up the resources of the land from ancient Sumer, Babylon, Egypt, Greece, Rome, to modern-day Western civilization and all its components. And it's this very way that we live that needs an entire re-examining and right away, like a crucial re-examining. And many are not looking this direction because questioning what seems to be solid and in place and looks like it's going to be here forever and last forever is not on their mind. People are not questioning the very way we live, and it's becoming detrimental to the planet and our lives. So Max Wilbert is my guest today. Max Wilbert is a third generation organizer who grew up in Seattle's post WTO anti-globalization and undoing racism movement. He is a co-founder of Deep Green Resistance and longtime board member of a small grassroots environmental nonprofit with no employees and no corporate funding. Max reached out to me about reading his book called We Choose to Speak, which is full of great breakdowns of the world we live in, great essays. And so I'm happy to have Max on. Welcome to the show, Max.
Thanks a lot, Loomis. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Well, hey, let me ask you first, being a third generation organizer, which I'd like to define better, but I think I know what you mean, was there even a moment of wake up for you, or were these thoughts already kind of embedded in you by having parents who were conscious?
Yeah, I think I was pretty lucky. I think they were somewhat already embedded. You know, from a young age, I was getting critical lessons about the media, about corporate culture, about consumerism, about war and imperialism and patriarchy and racism, and a lot of these ideas were circulating in my family and in my community. And so I feel really blessed for that, because I don't think I had to do as much work as some other people have to do. But, you know, I mean, the reality is all those things are out there in the world. They're pretty obvious to anyone who's paying attention and thinking critically. So even though I think I had the blessing and the benefit of that in my own family, you know, it anyone can get those lessons, and so many people do just by paying attention to what's going on around them.
Right, right. Was there like a moment that set you on fire more so, or was it like kind of always a mission because you were brought up that way somewhat?
A bit of both, I have to say. I probably really started getting, you know, more politically aware consciously and, it's funny. When I was probably maybe 11 or 12 years old, one of my friends, gave me a printed out paper copy of the Communist Manifesto, which I don't necessarily call myself a communist, even though I think there are a lot of good ideas that come out of that tradition. But we were in school, so our framing of it was, you know, the teachers are the bourgeoisie and the students are the proletariat, and we need to rise up, and, you know, they're getting paid to be here and to keep us locked up in these classrooms and force us to sit down, shut up, basically. And, you know, it's kind of humorous, but one of the essays in this book collection, kind of goes into the school system. And, you know, I think the fundamental critique even that I had at that age, that this school system isn't really set up to serve students, it's set up to serve, those in power, the capitalists, the business owners, you know, we all get our grades so we can decide, okay, these people will get the great, excellent grades, and then they'll go to Stanford and whatever Ivy League schools and become the managers and the CEOs and the future, you know, top bourgeoisie, the future 1%. And meanwhile, you know, the kids who are struggling, are going to be tracked into private prisons or low-wage jobs or, you know, exploitative labor of one sort or another.
So
I was sort of dabbling with these ideas from a pretty young age, and it was a multi-step process. It wasn't like there was just one moment where it all clicked and I understood everything, but I think I always had sort of a pretty robust critique of the dominant culture and the way that it does things, and, you know, that's just expanded over the years. I feel like I'm always learning and expanding my understanding of what's going on.
Yeah, that's how to be, because it's a continual learning process. Going back to what you say about the schools, I felt the same way, because I felt like it was one big prison. I felt like there was a big fence around the school to keep us in. Why couldn't we leave? Why couldn't we go do whatever we want? That wasn't my wake up per se, but it definitely already in my blood, I knew there was something wrong. Something was wrong there. But definitely schools were the start of me going, whoa, wait a minute. And I never got past that. But a lot of people do. But I guess I feel blessed, too, to have that unprogramming in my brain to know better than to get sucked into the indoctrination system.
Yeah, no doubt.
Well, go ahead. Sorry. Don't want to cut you off.
I was just going to say, I know it's so many people have that fundamental critique, you know, they understand sort of in their body, in their bones, just from living, that, you know, modern life is based on sweatshop labor, and that schools are inherently an unjust way of doing education. They just don't work fundamentally. And I think it takes a lot of work for people to convince themselves otherwise, you know? So I look around today and I see a lot of people who, they sort of, at their root, they have a fundamental understanding of what's going wrong and what sort of things are bad in the world today. And yet there's so many false solutions and so many false trails sort of leading people astray, causing people to invest more time and more energy in reforming these systems and, you know, working to change them in small ways that often, you know, may not have the intended results that people want.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of that. There's a lot of diversion, and there's a lot of people avoiding the truth and lying to themselves every day. That's a big problem, of course, because we lie to ourselves and we're coerced and everything. And maybe we should just get straight into your essays. I would like to share with the audience what the essays are about and maybe talk on a few. Maybe what you could do is read your table of contents, and then we'll just kind of pick a few and go from there.
Sure, sounds good.
Okay.
So this is, okay, I'll go through a list of the essay titles. We're actually coming out with a second edition of this book. The first one we kind of, a friend named Boris who lives in Germany, offered to put together this collection, and it's a bunch of essays that I wrote over a 5-year period or so. And so we kind of threw it together pretty quickly earlier this year, and people seem to enjoy it. It's kind of getting spread around a little bit.
Good.
So, we're putting together a second edition. So I'm reading from the first edition right now because the second is still a work in progress. So,
well, that's okay.
Okay. So, the first essay is called We Choose to Speak. The second is The Everyday Violence of Modern Culture. Mm-hmm. Then there's a couple, Falling in Love and Utah, the Next Energy Colony. And the next one is called Lost in Pocatello. Those three are sort of about campaigns and being out on the land.
Okay.
Then we've got one called I Write What I Like, which is a book review of a biography and a collection of writings by Steve Biko, the South African anti-apartheid activist. Then I've got an article about Cliff Mass, who is a Seattle-based meteorologist who I think is a dangerous person, a sort of new breed of climate denier is what I call him.
Okay.
Then moving on, we've got 15 points on organizing, the importance of skills and equipment for resistance movements, the modern COINTELPRO and how to fight it, fighting sexual objectification is not exclusionary, and then the three essays to finish it out five essays to finish it out are all sort of about the fact that what we're doing doesn't seem to be working. You know, on the big scale, things are getting worse. And so those essays are titled, What Do We Do When Mass Movements Fail? Is the Climate Movement Making Progress? Time is Short Towards a Revolution. Ecological Special Forces. And then the final two essays are Resource Extraction and Revolutionary Unity, and then Practicing Lawbreaking is the final one.
Cool. That sounds like a lot of work that... Some of the best works, I feel, are works that happened over a span of time, and you put it together. I really enjoy those kind of works.
Cool.
Well, one that stood out to me that you read was actually one of the very first ones, The Everyday Violence of Modern Culture. Maybe we can get into that one a little bit, just because I see that on the daily, and I realize, too, that what it takes to be here and do what we do every day is violence and coercion. So I think that might be a great place to start.
Okay, cool. Let's jump into it. Well, I can tell you a little bit about the premise of this article,
Sure. Which
is, you know, I thought I would just kind of trace an average day in this culture. You know, I grew up in Seattle, which is, you know, this sort of wealthy, imperial city that, you know, its wealth is based on companies like Amazon and Boeing and, you know, the logging companies, Weyerhaeuser and you know, you've got Microsoft, you've got the Port of Seattle. And as I've become more and more aware of the issues in the world, it's hard to not think about the violence that it took to set up that way of life and the violence it takes to maintain that way of life.
Right.
So in this article, I'll just go ahead and read a couple paragraphs from it.
Yeah, sure.
And maybe we can discuss it.
Yeah.
So this is sort of like a walking through a day. First, you wake up on top of a foam mattress, off-gassing toxic chemicals that won't biodegrade for 10,000 years. You sit up and put on your clothes, all with tags reading Bangladesh and Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic. These clothes were made by virtual slaves. You walk downstairs and fill a glass with water from the tap. The water comes from a local river that was dammed 127 years ago. Ever since, native species in the watershed have been in decline. You drink the water. You pour yourself a bowl of cereal. The cereal is made of wheat and corn, grown in what was once the tall grass prairie of the eastern Great Plains. 99% of that habitat, millions upon millions of acres, was plowed and utterly destroyed to grow those crops. The soil is gone now. Your meal is only possible because of fossil fuel fertilizers. You add milk. It comes from a factory farm nearby, where cattle are packed in next to each other in squalor and pumped full of antibiotics and genetically modified growth hormones to increase milk production. The cows are in pain. Their imprisonment is fouling the land around them. The cereal tastes good. It's almost time for work, so you walk down to your car. You're somewhat environmentally conscious, so you bought an electric car. It makes you feel a lot better. The car has 1,000 pounds of lithium-ion batteries. The lithium for those batteries was strip-mined in the Peruvian desert. The pollution and land destroyed by the mining has destroyed local people's traditional livelihoods. You get inside and start up the engine. It's a push-button startup system. There's a fancy LCD screen. It's modern and sleek. You pull away from the curb. You drive on paved streets to your destination. Under those streets are indigenous burial grounds. There used to be thick old-growth forest here. Now it's a trendy, up-and-coming neighborhood. There are a few run-down houses here and there. But the poor people who used to live in this neighborhood are being forced to move, many after generations here. They're just the latest set of refugees. So this article goes on, you know, the person, the hypothetical person in the article goes to their job, and I go through some of the other violence that is just surrounding them. And this article is really about how we live inside of violent culture. And the point of it, I'm not really trying to, like, put the blame on individuals. I'm not really trying to say, like, everyone needs to buy a non-toxic mattress and everyone needs to buy only clothes that, you know, are not from sweatshop labor, and everyone needs to get their water from springs and so on. You know, people should do those things if they can, but often those aren't choices because of poverty, you know?
Right.
And so I think, you know, I'm not trying to put the onus on individuals. This essay is more about, let's recognize that this system that we live inside, this culture, this industrial empire, this global modern civilization that we live in, is only possible through constant violence. And it's built on violence. It was founded on violence, and it's maintained by violence. Yeah. And that's true whether you look at the paint on the walls that comes from fossil fuels that were, you know, maybe ripped out of the ground in Nigeria or in Tennessee or in Alberta. And it's true if you look at light bulbs, and it's true if you look at, you know, the bricks that the side of the house is made of, and it's true if you look at basically any product of this culture. So it's a pretty sober essay, but I think people need to look at these things honestly. So that was my goal there.
Yeah, no, that's cool. I really enjoy that little breakdown. And it also says, without, like you say, pinning it on individuals, it's kind of a slap in the face to the whole, quote unquote green movement that isn't even green, that, we can, you know, you think you feel good because you're driving your electric car, or, you know, people that think they're making a difference, but they're not looking at this bigger picture. They're just still maintaining the destruction of the earth and their own slavery every day. And that brings to mind that this existence is one big lie. It's only propped up because we've been lied to and tricked to believe it. I mean, and people have not researched it either, but also we lie to ourselves every day that it's okay. Like I was saying before, we are coerced to live this way every day too. And if we were to let our daily lives, whatever we feel is natural, like chill in nature and basically do nothing, I think life would look a lot different also, because we wouldn't be getting in. I also don't think that humans would have come up with this system on their own without this coercion. I think humans have a moral compass, but it's been completely turned around and they've been completely locked down. So like when you say, another thing that came to mind is when you say that we can't pin it on an individual, or you can't get too upset that you're not, getting water from a spring. We're painted into a corner. We're trapped that way. So we can only do our best. But yeah, we are, our backs are against the wall.
Yeah, no doubt. Yep. Yeah, this system, and I think that's another example of the violence in this system is, you know, I mean, poverty and capitalism itself. You know, I have a day job that I do it. I don't really care about it. But you know, I have to do it because I need some money to survive. And I live outside the system as much as I can. I do a lot of foraging. I live in a place where my rent is really, really cheap out in the woods. Nice. I do a lot of, you know, work trades and share resources with people and do everything I can to live outside the system, because that's just a better way to live, I think. I enjoy it a lot more than working 40 hours a week and living in the middle of a big city or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that it's really hard to do that. And, you know, I'm lucky to live in a state where there's decent publicly funded healthcare, and there's, you know, a few decent social support programs. And I'm also pretty lucky to be a white male, to have been born a white male in this culture. So, you know, I'm already starting with a lot of privilege and a lot of preferential access to resources compared to a lot of people. And, you know, so many people are just living check to check. They're constantly afraid of falling behind on their bills. They're already behind on their bills. They're in debt. You know, they need that job. And, you know, if not, they're going to end up on the street. They can't pay for their medical care. They can't get food for their kids. And, you know, what happens if you don't do those things is you're going to end up in one of those private prisons. And you're going to make profit for somebody that way. You know, and that involves usually the police or somebody coming with a gun to force you to, you know, to go to prison, or, you know, go to prison and work for a dollar an hour doing slave labor.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's this violence that's built in that way too, that reinforces, you know, that keeps people in the system and prevents people from, and destroys alternatives actively in terms of targeting indigenous communities, you know, targeting people who are, trying to build alternative ways to live, you know, constantly destroying those other visions. There's sort of this internal repression, keeping people down, keeping people in line, keeping people scared and in debt and, you know, working within the system, and then destroying any sort of alternative in the outside world.
Yeah. And to say that this culture is not built on violence is insane, because if you just put out the scenario in my head of people being on the streets, and then they're obviously, there's going to be some law they're breaking, so then they're going to go to prison, and that's violence. That's, if you don't comply, then that they're going to show physical violence, but it's all violent,
yeah.
Constantly coercion and violence.
Yeah,
I saw the other day here in Honolulu, I saw the police moving a set of homeless people. There was probably like 10 There was just nowhere for, I mean, they're just dismantling their entire infrastructure of what they have as a living space. There's obviously nowhere for them to go, but there's like five cops with their arms crossed, you know, waiting for these people to pick up their stuff and go somewhere else. Right. And I looked at that and I was just, I was appalled by it. And it actually just reminds me of, local politics here back in the 80s. There's a guy that you might enjoy researching. His name is Bumpy Kanahele. He was a Hawaiian activist here who wanted to reclaim Hawaiian lands. And so they lived a traditional Hawaiian way, in grass huts on some land. Well, if you watch, it's like a 1985 video. The police came and made him go out, and locked him up and made him leave the premises. And the kids were like, where are we going to go? We don't have anywhere to live. Where are we going to go? These are like young kids saying that. And it brought a couple tears to my eyes. I was actually like sad because it was so emotional to see their parents being locked up and carried into cop cars. And, you know, it's like, and that's been paved over. I feel that these days are so much, I don't know if you see the same, but I feel like these days we don't even have people challenging the system like that anymore. We don't even have people, like trying to even live that way. It's like that's been stripped out of people's heads. Now they're just filled with media, their cell phones, they're distracted. They're not even like full of any revolutionary thought. Not many people I see anyway.
Yeah, it's unfortunately it's a pretty dystopian retrograde world we live in right now. And you know, that said, like I'm a pretty happy person on a day-to-day basis. I'm lucky. I have family who I love. I have friends who I love. I have community. You know, I have things that I love to do, and you know, and I'm not going to give that up and just live in misery because the world is going to hell. I think a lot of people have this idea that people who recognize these things and who are willing to look at them honestly are just going to be super depressed all the time.
Yeah, I got an email from someone not recently, but thinking that I must be this miserable person. I'm like, no, I enjoy life to the fullest degree. I love my life.
Yeah.
But I also see what goes on, and I'm not going to just shut my mouth. And there's got to be voices for that out there.
Right.
And action.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I feel like, you know, for me, I don't know. I feel like we owe it to the world to enjoy life. And you know, one of the purposes of human beings or of life in general is to enjoy, I think.
Absolutely.
And you know, so what you said earlier about just chilling out, you know, and you know, hanging out in nature and enjoying it, you know, I think that's huge, you know, although I do think that I try and do that, but I think it has to be paired with sort of a fierce warrior spirit. And that's something that I've seen from what I know of, you know, indigenous Hawaiian resistance movements and, you know, indigenous resistance movements all around the world and people's movements and union organizing and revolutionaries and all kinds of people fighting for liberation. You know, they have this fierce spirit and this fierce dedication to justice and this fierce sense of right and wrong that they cultivate in themselves, and they work to build up this sense of who they are and what they believe in and what they're going to stand up for. And so that sort of relaxing and enjoying life, I think, has to be paired with that because, let's see, let me pull up this quote real quick.
Sure.
I saw this the other day, and what is, okay, just give me a quick second here.
Yeah, well, so what you're saying too is correct because, my last guest I had on was Mark Devlin, and in the end of the interview, he was talking about how we can't just sit around and wait for things to get bad. I mean, what kind of legacy does that leave for our kids or the future of the planet? So we do have to have that balance. Yes, you gotta enjoy life to become a happy individual and fulfill your soul, because we can't just be miserable, but we that know have to we have a job to do here, and actually I get fulfilled from doing the job too, from, you know, and this is minimal, just being on the radio. I mean, it reaches people, but it's, you know, it's not doing a big thing. It helps, but, you know, you gotta at least do something with the people that know, have to do something. They can't just sit around and store this information. We have to put up some kind of resistance toward what's going on.
Yeah, and here's the quote I have, which speaks directly to that. It's from a book called Capitalist Realism by a person named Mark Fisher. And I haven't actually read the book, and I don't know Mark Fisher at all, so I can't comment on any more of his work. But I saw this quote and thought it was very interesting. So the quote is, "Many of the teenage students I encounter seem to be in a state of what I would call depressive hedonia. Depression is usually characterized as a state of anhedonia, but the condition I'm referring to is constituted not by an inability to get pleasure, so much it is by an inability to do anything else except pursue pleasure. There is a sense that something is missing, but no appreciation that this mysterious missing enjoyment can only be accessed beyond the pleasure principle." And I thought that was an interesting quote because, you know, I work with young people now and then. You know, I take some kids backpacking and, you know, work with kids in nature. And it's always interesting to me because I feel like you really get a sense of what the culture is because, you know, there's nobody more up on pop culture generally than a bunch of eighth graders.
Right.
So you kind of get a sense of, like, what's going down, what are the ideas that are really big in the pop culture world, in the world that young people are growing up in. And I think I see some of this, what he calls depressive hedonia, an inability to do anything else except pursue pleasure. I see some of that, and I see some of that among older people as well. You know, I'm only 30, so I'm pretty young too. But I see some of that around, and you know, so I definitely enjoy most of the activist work, the organizing and resistance work that I do.
Yeah.
But I certainly don't enjoy all of it. It's often really hard. It's sometimes scary. It's sometimes dangerous. You know, sometimes it really sucks and it's exhausting, you know. But like the end of that quote says, that this mysterious missing enjoyment can only be accessed beyond pleasure. And, you know, I think that we do get that deep sense of meaning and sense of self when we are doing something, you know, something difficult and something in service of our community, something that's a challenge. So, you know, I think that's sort of what we all need to strive for, is finding that right balance between taking good care of ourselves and living in a good way in our communities and enjoying ourselves, and sort of having that, like, vision of the world as a good place to fall back on and be our root and our foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, sort of step outside your comfort zone and fight and organize and, you know, and push back against corporate control and against empire and against all these, you know, racism and patriarchy and all these different things.
Right. Yeah, totally, man. And so you talked about working with young kids, or eighth graders and things. One of your essays went in, you were talking about, I don't know the title, that has to do with the school system. Did you want to read a little bit about that?
Sure, let me open that one up here. Okay. School system. You know what? I think I made a mistake. The school system one is going to be in the second edition.
Oh, okay.
But I have it on my I have it on my computer. Let me pull that up here.
Well, it's the base of our mind control, beginning of it, and I think it kind of shows how we get desensitized to the world we live in, just being brought up in a school full of other prisoners, that's what I would call them instead of students, and just being institutionalized. So we accept the reality that we live in and this violence of culture much easier You know, they always weed out the kids that don't assimilate well. And then you eventually either they have to assimilate, or those are the ones that eventually go in the private prison systems when they get older.
Yeah, so this essay is called "Is the School System Redeemable?" No, which is a pretty blunt title, but I like being blunt. I'm not really one for a lot of you know, I like poetry and I like that type of stuff, but I'm not really into philosophy, and I don't really like to beat around the bush. And I enjoy conversations and whatever, but anyway, that's beside the point. So the essay. I wrote this because my partner was working in a school for a year, and she had a really rough time because she was forced to stick to the curriculum, and it was all so predefined in terms of, you know, you have to teach this and make sure you cover this for the standardized tests, and, you know, a lot of testing and a lot of standards, and it was a rough experience, and she got out of it. Pretty quickly, luckily, but so I had this dream one night, and I start the essay by talking about the dream, and I can just read that.
Sure.
Last night I dreamt that I was trapped in a box. I was in high school again, sitting at an antique desk with a wraparound writing surface, right-handed, of course, for a left-handed child, and I was more bored than any person should ever be. As the teacher played out their sanctioned role, trying to make compulsory education fun and engaging, I sat in a stupor, craving some stimulation, lest the torpor become permanent and turn me into a compliant drone for life. I refused to be turned into a cubicle occupant. In the dream, my solution was to stand up and start removing the bug screens from the windows. My boredom was temporarily cast aside, and the fresh air flowed into the classroom, enlivening the other occupants, reminding them of the real world. The teacher frowned in annoyance. It was a win-win, a small act of rebellion, no doubt, but I would not be cowed into sitting meekly. This dream could have been a flashback. I behaved this way in high school, pushing the boundaries as far as I could, ignoring teachers unless they earned my respect, and even then ignoring rules that seemed silly to me, giving friendships only to those teachers who in turn pushed the boundaries. I respected them as people, but after all, they were being paid to attend school. I was legally obligated. Education can be a great experience, but at least here in the United States, the school system exists entirely to serve the dominant economic system. Grades separate out those with a combination of traits, intelligence, defined in the most culturally blinkered and capitalist terms, and obedience, that make them suitable to be the next managers. Those who fail will make up the poor and working class from which wealth will be extracted. Punitive measures and the brutal, relentless school-to-prison pipeline enforce and inculcate white supremacy. And I go on to talk about, you know, a variety of other problems with the school, and you know, I talk about how I had this teacher in 10th grade, my journalism teacher, who was really he was excellent. He was amazing. He was teaching us critical thinking. He was teaching us about advertising and mass media and how that these platforms are manipulated to teach racism, to teach objectification of women, to teach consumerism. But, you know, as I say later on in the essay, the school system isn't broken. It's functioning exactly as it was meant to. And then I finally give the example of, you know, I read this book a couple years ago called People of the Pines, and it's the story of the Mohawk community in Oka, which is near Montreal in Canada. Mm-hmm. And this Mohawk community, I think in the year 1990, one of their sacred sites, it was a pine forest, was slated for development, slated for destruction, to build a new housing development and a golf course, I believe. And so the Mohawks from that community, they organized and they went to the public meetings and they submitted comments and they testified and they, you know, they went through all the legal channels to try and stop this project, and it didn't work. So they started occupying the site and they set up a blockade on the dirt road that led through the forest, and pretty soon people started showing up and harassing them, and there were some threats of violence against them, and so some of the Mohawk warriors from their warrior societies started carrying weapons at the blockade. And so eventually this escalated. The Canadian military was called in, and something like 2,000 soldiers were brought in from the Canadian military, and with armored vehicle support and so on. And they attempted to come in and break the blockade, and a shootout broke out. Nobody really knows to this day who fired the first shots. But one police officer was killed, and it turned into a standoff that went on for 73 days, I think. Mm. And in the end, it was sort of a draw. A lot of the warriors escaped, and no charges were brought against them. A few of them were charged. The development didn't happen, but it also, the land wasn't turned over to the Mohawks. So it was sort of a draw in the end. But it was this massive international incident. You had Indigenous nations all across Canada doing solidarity actions and blockading railroads and seizing bridges. One of the main bridges into and out of Montreal was captured by a group of Mohawk warriors who, you know, we're stopping tens of thousands of commuters from going across this bridge every day. It was a big political crisis in Canada.
What year was this? I missed what you said. What year it was?
It was 1990.
Oh wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I read this book about it called People of the Pines, which was written by a couple journalists who were behind the barricades with the Mohawk warriors for the entire duration of the standoff. And one of the things they talked about is how in Mohawk culture, from what I understand, children are treated as miniature adults. And so they're expected to learn through basically participating in everyday life. And, you know, governance and survival and what it takes to get by. So they're not trapped in a box. They're actually brought out and exposed to the real world. And during this blockade, there were a bunch of children who were behind the blockade with the warriors and the other people, the other Mohawks. And what they said was, you know, people said, this is child abuse, or you're being, you know, you shouldn't have kids back there. And their response was, you know, we've had to fight to defend our land for hundreds of years, and we need our children to know how this works, to know how to do things, and to learn from reality. You know, we don't need to protect them and coddle them. We need to train them and allow them to learn. And, you know, that's kind of an extreme example, but I like to share it because it's such a contrast to sitting in a box in high school and just, you know, sweating and those end of school hot days as the summer is coming on, and all you want to do is be out of there, and you just don't give a damn about, you know, whatever. The teachers want to be gone, the students want to be gone, and, you know, nobody's learning anything at that point. And it's such a huge contrast, and you know, I think it really, it's no surprise that when we have such a dysfunctional school system, that we're bringing up young people who don't know what to do to address global warming, to address imperialism, to fight patriarchy, to fight racism. You know, this, our culture is in general pretty dysfunctional, And the school system certainly isn't helping that. So, you know, my conclusion for that essay was, in a world flush with refugees, overwhelmed by neocolonialism, sweltering under global warming, sweating in fear of rising fascist elements, and yoked with the chains of sex and race oppression, perhaps it's time we gave up on the school system and started working to tear it and the system it supports down.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's awesome. What you said kind of just cemented everything about the schools. I know that the way of learning is just, is wrong in the first place, because what you're learning is you're regurgitating facts to be put back out through your filter of a mind into tests to pass. And then you delete that information because you don't need it. You don't really need it. You just needed it to pass the test. And those kids on that reservation are, they're learning life skills. And, you know, it just tells you right there. I had talked to some people a little while ago about how they travel a lot, and they just travel with their kids and homeschool them, and they have a way better awareness of this world than any kid they meet that's been institutionalized.
Right.
Well, I know we only have,
it's
like,
really,
go ahead, sorry.
It's really like how to be a human being, you know?
Yeah.
It's like anyone can learn math or learn, you know, whatever technical skills if they really need to for whatever reason in their life, they can learn it, you know? Teach people to read, teach people how to learn, and they can learn whatever they need to learn. But most people don't get taught how to be human beings, how to be good people, how to, you know, how to navigate morally challenging situations.
No, not at all. Not at all. It's not part of the curriculum.
Yeah.
I hate that word even. It just drives bad memories for me. Well, before because we only got about 10 minutes, and one of the things that stood out in your sort of conclusion of your book was time is short toward a revolution. And I think, you know, if we get into any crucial, like, what to do kind of situations, it sounds like that is a pretty strong topic maybe to leave people with, too.
Yeah, for sure. So, this article is, it's really about how many activists are beating our heads against the wall. You know, people have been trying to make the better world a better place for so long, and generally things are getting worse. That's not true everywhere. It's not true in every situation, but by and large, things are getting worse. And I've been trying to go through this shift lately in my own mind, because I think we need to start thinking less like activists and more like revolutionaries.
Yeah.
You know, our and, well, so one of the quotes that I share in this article is from a guy who was on the National Security Council. And he says, beforehand, all revolutions seem impossible. In retrospect, all revolutions seem inevitable.
Yeah, I've heard that before. Yeah.
I love that quote because, you know, sometimes it sure as hell seems impossible to me. But, you know, so in this essay, I kind of go into, there's a section called Mythical Strategies. And I talk about how we sort of have this whole mythology about how social change happens, by convincing people, by changing people's minds one by one. And that's not really very accurate. I mean, if you look at big movements like the Civil Rights Movement, for example, it was a tiny minority of people in the country who supported the Civil Rights Movement. The, you know, the overwhelming majority of the population was either opposed or neutral.
Yeah.
And, you know, this small minority, this small group of people was able to push through some big changes, which of course are being rolled back in terms of like the dismantling of the Voting Rights Act and the dismantling of all these things. But, you know, I talk about how, you know, the destruction of the planet that we're seeing today, the environmental crisis, it isn't really an environmental crisis or a climate crisis. It's really more accurate to say that it's a war being waged against the planet by industrial culture, by civilization, by capitalism, by empire,
yeah.
You know, whatever terms you want to use. And, you know, if you change that framing, then that helps understand why we need to change the framing from activism to revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what happens when our strategies aren't working? You know, what do you do when, you know, you've voted, you've petitioned, you've demanded change, you've protested, maybe you've even blockaded, you've locked down things, you've stopped the trains, you've blocked the roads, and it hasn't worked. You know, what do you do? Do you keep using the same tactics and expect that they're going to work at some point in the future? You know, do you give up? These aren't really hypothetical questions either, because myself and a lot of other people I know have done all those things, and they're not really working.
Right.
And, you know, this is a situation that people have faced again and again throughout history, and it really comes down to me to thinking about, you know, being committed to winning, being committed to changing the world. And, you know, if you look at, like, people like Jeff Bezos, you know, the richest man in the world, and I was watching an interview with him, and he's talking about, you know, population growth is a great thing, and economic growth is a great thing, and, you know, these power civilization, and we need more and more of this, not less and less. That's pretty much a direct quote from Jeff Bezos. And, you know, those are the type of people who are really controlling the way that our culture is developing, and the direction that the world is going in. So it's no surprise that this culture is destroying everything. And, you know, people like him are playing for keeps, you know?
Yeah.
They're winning. They're investing heavily, and they are winning. And so, you know, my conclusion here is basically that we need to consider any means necessary, because we're in a crisis situation. And that shift in framing inside our own heads from activist to revolutionary, it allows us to start treating the struggle more seriously. And it allows us to start thinking, instead of petitions, to start thinking about revolutions. You know, one of my friends put up a petition years ago that said, the petition was called, it was addressed to those in power, and it was called, "Please Stop Ignoring Our Petitions." And, you know, I thought that was a pretty funny one. In this essay, I look at the Cuban Revolution, which obviously wasn't perfect. You know, I talk a little bit about what happened in Cuba, but, you know, obviously what happened in Cuba wasn't perfect. It's not a utopian society, but it is nonetheless very interesting how a small group of people built support in the countryside among disaffected people, built a revolutionary movement, and toppled a dictatorship in a pretty short time. And, you know, basically fended off the most powerful empire in the world, the United States, for decades afterwards. And then I also talk about the Dakota Access Pipeline and how, you know, the Standing Rock struggle was such a huge fight, and, you know, tens of thousands of people mobilized to fight that pipeline, and they weren't able to stop it. And, you know, the most effective actions that were done to stop that pipeline were done by small groups of people who were working with people who they trusted, and who weren't really concerned with public opinion so much as they were with physically stopping the pipeline.
Right.
I think we need public opinion. Like, that's why I'm on a radio show right now, for example. We need to work with public opinion and ideas and so on. But when you think like a revolutionary, then the question becomes not so much how do we convince people, but the question becomes how do we stop the enemy from doing what they want to do? So if they want to build a pipeline, how do we physically stop that? And so I talk about, you know, some of the direct action that was done against that pipeline in terms of the nonviolent blockades, and also the the women who sabotaged the pipeline, you know, two women who had a huge impact on that pipeline, you know, stopped construction for weeks when, you know, 10,000 people in the main camp were struggling to stop it as well.
That's a good point.
So, yeah, that's sort of the conclusion of this whole essay collection is, you know, we need to start thinking much more seriously and start thinking like a serious revolutionary movement.
Right. I went going just to what you said about public opinion. I think it is important because then you have larger numbers, but it's
right.
not going to happen quick enough, fast enough, and we are dealing with kind of a timeline, I think. I know we got, probably, you got to go soon, probably in a little bit, or?
Yeah, I got a little time if you want to keep going for a few more minutes.
Yeah, just for a few more, we'll wrap it up. One concept that I think is really important with public opinion is what I call bridging the gap. For example, most, if practically not all concepts I talk about on this show are pretty extreme, at least if someone were to drop into one of my shows without sort of prepping themselves, they would probably get, well, maybe uncomfortable or even get offended and turn it off. But another
right.
example is, I don't believe in any form of government, but I used to have some extremist anarchist friends who were willing to change our scenario with guns in the name of defending Earth. They never did, but let's say they did, and they did something big. Without an understanding of how bad things are and why it's a legitimate reason for force, how is anyone ever going to understand and grow from that? So what I mean by bridging the gap is people need to really know what time it is, and they don't really. And common people need to understand where a mindset to not want government and civilization even comes from. So that was always my critique on them. I would just tell them, you know, is because they were coming from a very, very small minority group with relatively no voice that people could latch onto. But we need the masses on our side. But then, you know, it doesn't take that many people to get something going at the same time. So I guess both are good, you know.
Absolutely.
But bridging the gap is important because I think most people's hearts, like I was saying, moral compass, people have good hearts and they want to do what's right, and they think by serving the system they're doing what's right.
Yeah.
And that has to change to where they realize, for example, this is a violence culture of violence, like you said in the beginning. It has to change. Now, this is a little wild card, but I'm just going to throw it in. I don't know what your opinion is, but with people who, I've seen some people change quick and often better with the use of psychedelics. I don't know what your thoughts on that is, but for some people, I feel like it brings a conscious awareness that is more instantaneous because they needed that intervention in their mind, or they would have continued on with their own mind program. I don't know how you feel about the use of psychedelics for people that need to get past some barriers.
Yeah, I mean, they can certainly be really useful for people, and, you know, powerful plant medicines that people have been using for thousands of years. And you know, I think that plant medicines are a tool that healthy communities use throughout history, but they're just one type of tool, just like, you know, just like community itself can be useful, and just like relationships and ways of relating and ceremony and song and dance and storytelling and you know, different types of communication and child rearing and all these things, you know, play a role in community, setting up community. I think it's the same with those type of plant medicines, entheogens, and you know, I don't think that they're the one thing that's going to turn the tide, but I know that I've had some transformative experiences with those plant medicines and found them to be good healers and good teachers. I certainly don't think they're really recreational drugs, and that's not something that I'm really into. But, you know, in terms of, yeah, like you say, breaking down some barriers, helping people perceive the world as it really is and get rid of some of their own filtering, that can be pretty powerful.
I guess sometimes I think when I see some people who are just stuck in their ways that are contributing to our problems, I just think, what would happen if they had a big mushroom trip and they just suddenly saw the world in a new light? But, and again, it's not recreational. It is not something that you just do. You got to have preparation. And that's what the indigenous did. They prepared and they and today's settings are not places to do it in. You got to go to nature, I feel. I mean, you don't go to a party and do it or anything, but, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. That's sometimes I get thinking that way when I think about people that are just and the world that's seemingly unchanging. Would that also help? But
I really encourage people to try and. I was just thinking yesterday about how, you know, I've tried to structure my life in such a way that I can put a lot of time towards organizing, and towards, you know, what I have a passion for, which is trying to build revolutionary consciousness, build revolutionary movements, normalize revolutionary skills and mindsets. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people should try and, that's the challenge to people who are listening, is move your life in that direction. Start having those conversations. You know, change the way you work, change the way you live, change the way you consume. You know, turn off the radio, turn off the TV, turn off the YouTube. You know, and instead start studying revolutionary texts and history, and, you know, start working with people in your own community and work on yourself to improve your own strengths so that you can be of service more to revolutionary movements in support of justice and in support of, you know, true, real sustainability, real relationship with the land. Because, you know, we need warriors, we need healers, we need people who are going to fight for the world, and you know, those people aren't going to come from outer space. Those people are us. We have to become those people.
Exactly.
And you know, that's a challenge for us, but it's also an opportunity, because like we said earlier, you know, when you're really searching for identity, for meaning, for a sense of self, you can find it in that place.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I appreciate you coming on. I think we're heading to the end here. Your website, what is your website again?
Yeah, my website is maxwilbert.org. That's maxwilbert.org.
Okay. And how can people purchase your book?
I've got copies on there. You can also order it into any local bookstore. I grew up in the Amazon town, so I'm not a supporter of that company.
Yeah.
But you know, I recommend you can order it into your local bookstore using the ISBN number, and yeah, you can contact me on that website. I'm on some social media platforms. Try to avoid them as much as possible, but use them to spread ideas. You know, again, just trying to be pragmatic, not purist, but. You know, reach out and connect if you're interested, and I appreciate people listening and appreciate you having me on.
Hey, thanks for coming on, Max. I appreciate your work, and I think it's definitely good, and it breaks down so much. The people need to start thinking about the whole, you know, civilization, or as you say, culture of empire. I think that's another way to look at it, too, is define it even better, possibly, is that we have never got out from under this culture of empire all the way back to ancient Sumeria, and we're still forced. This one's even the most planet-eating, killing machine ever, the Western society. So it's time. So, hey, man, I appreciate you coming on the show, and keep in touch, and thanks for chanting down the system.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, all right.
All right. Have a great day, Lomas.
Yeah, you too. Take care, Max.
Bye.
And that was Max Wilbert.
another show, episode 112. I hope you enjoy that. I like to have an eclectic variety of subjects on this show, and I hope you've been enjoying this Swiss Army knife of different subject matter being thrown at you. I like to get an eclectic bit of subject matter from an eclectic variety of voices so we can understand things better, understand the truth better. I think it's important not to get all your information from one source, but from many, and pull from many. Take what you want, leave what you don't like that doesn't sit well, but bring it in and take it with you so you can get a fuller picture. This episode, 112, is part 3 of the Understanding Rebellion series, which I failed to mention in the interview. I just spaced it, but this is a newer series of shows if you want to go on to the website, chantitdownradio.com. I feel that many people don't go to the website, chantitdownradio.com, and a lot of people don't realize there's a website for the show. And it is. It's there. And it helps. I would be confused if I was a listener and I didn't know there was a website, because most, not all of my shows, but a lot of them are linked into mini series of shows. And so if you're not knowing where part 5 of something is because I did it a year later from part 4, then go to the series of shows page and you scroll down and you'll find all these series in order and listen that way. Much easier. I mean, you don't have to listen to part 1 and part 2 of this Understanding Rebellion series to hear this show because, well, you already heard it, but also they're not connected in a way of stair-step information or prerequisite type of information. But anyway, I think it's important to do that. So when you go to the series of shows page, you can scroll down, and if you scroll all the way to the bottom, you'll find this series of shows called Understanding Rebellion. It's the newest one I put up, which kind of came out of nowhere. I didn't expect to be making a series of shows, but I realized that episode 103 and episode 110 were related enough that they really deserve to be combined, and kind of, and with this show too, which deals with similar subject matter, to put together a series of shows like this. Now, if you enjoy this subject matter on this show, then you might enjoy also episode 40 and 41, which were the last two episodes of the System Tentacles series of shows, which would be my strong advice not to listen to those until you've listened to all those in order, because they're a stair-step progression. Also, read the blog. A lot of people have not realized that the blogs on the radio show, the System Tentacles blog, which really goes over all this in a maybe a 2.0 version of what I originally did, because the System Tentacles was an older series of show, the oldest pretty much on this show, to where I didn't have my hosting skills as good as now. I've learned some things, and but still worthy of a listen, because it's all about the subject matter. It's all about the information, not the messenger so much. At that point, though, I was still kind of learning how to do a show and stuff, but still, it's all worthy information. Another bit of another miniseries that kind of deals with the same subject matter of this show, this episode, is the Frustrated Man in Civilization series. And that's another one that I think that if you enjoy kind of the subject of this show and talking about civilization and stuff like that, then check out that series of shows too, and that'll get you somewhere. You know, some of the best things are spontaneous, that come out of nowhere. Max contacted me out of nowhere. I didn't know who he was. I didn't know anything about him, but, you know, and then, so I had him on, and I think it's great. So, if you know anyone that would like to be on the show that you think has worthy information, or you yourself have worthy information to bring on air that would be beneficial to putting pieces of this puzzle together and understanding, then please contact me at peoplebeyondthis@gmail.com. Also, comments, questions, just contact me at peoplebeyondthis@gmail.com. So that's my goal is to get a unity of voices that are speaking the truth, and they may come from different perspectives that may not completely agree with each other entirely, But there's great truths that need to be taken out of perspectives. And honestly, in order for us to proceed here on the planet past the stage we're at with all this craziness, is we all need to unify and understand that all the information that I try to bring here on this show is crucial to an all-encompassing picture of the truth. It all contributes to it, and everybody can learn from each other. So that's why I like this eclectic variety on the show, and I hope you do too. Now, and if you like to support, please support the show. The show here is, I'm a one-man show, and Patreon is a possible way you can do that. I have not touched the Patreon account since I created it, but I have, if you want to support, it's Loomis of Chant It Down Radio, then what you can do is you can go on and you can become a member, and you will get my other podcast, The Underground, which I have one episode so far of. And that's more of my musical side. It's going to be more of my personal reflections and more of a personal show. And I think that if you enjoy this show, then you'll enjoy The Underground. Also, you'll have access to my album, Waking the Systemites, and eventually a documentary, Everything Chanted Down. So those are ways you can help. But also go to the website if you really just want to simply just not be, but be bothered with trying to join anything. I understand. Put a tip in the jar on the support page on the website, and or buy an album that way too. It helps. And I'm not looking for monetary gain on this show. I'm not trying to be rich off of podcasts or anything like that. No way. I have a full-time job, and I have a full-time life. I do this out of my own efforts for free, and I would like to be able to make more off of it, get more back from it, I should say, and that would be a nice thing, so I can take it to the next level. Because if I had more time to put into it, I would have more quality to put into these shows, more taking it to the next level. And I'm ready to, actually, whether maybe it be joining a network. I don't know if I'd like. I kind of like my freedom, but we'll see. Or maybe doing a televised show, more of a recorded live show like some people do. Or there are a variety of things that I would like to do if I had more time. So that's where the support comes in. And if I could, I would not looking to make a living off of this. And this is not a popularity contest either. I'm not here to get popular off of this at all, or get liked by a bunch of people or whatever. I'm not here to make a bunch of friends or anything. I'm here for the information. The information brought me here. And if you like the information and it helps you, then help support if you can, and if anything, just spread the word. The show is hard to spread when you're a one man show. So if you have the means of spreading the word, please do so. It helps out. So, I think that's enough ranting for me. I hope you enjoy everything and keep chanting down the system and be a warrior, not a worrier. All right. Much love, you guys.
People beyond. awake now? Are you awake now?
Wake up!
Wake up!
Wake up!
Waking up!
Are you awake now? Are you awake now?
To confirm?
Are you awake now?